Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening. Thank you for listening to this new edition of Rated LGBT Radio. I am your host, Rob Watson, and tonight we are covering some of the hot LGBTQ topics of the week. We are going to focus tonight on one topic in particular when we get to it, and that is something that happened just today with the House of Representatives passing what is being called the Truman Amendment, that is attached to a military spending bill. And this amendment flies in the face of the initiatives of the Trump administration, and not only would permit transgender military service, but it also protects from discrimination against LGBT service members. So we will be discussing that. On deck tonight, I have my trusty co-host, Brody Levesque, and we are also welcoming our special guest, analyst and activist, Bryn Tannehill. Bryn has been a regular guest on our show, and we always appreciate her perspective and insight, and we will get more of that tonight. I want to welcome them both to the show. Brody and Bryn, welcome. Welcome aboard.
Good evening, Rob.
Thank
hey,
Brody.
You guys there?
Hey, Brody. Yep.
I was worried I pushed the wrong buttons there. So, you guys, I want to ask about something before we get started in some of the other topics, because we want to talk about some of the other things that have happened this week. But one thing that came out, and this wasn't news because we already knew about it, but yesterday, this was something that was covered by NBC, and I'm pointing that out because this is an article in the past that I would have expected to see in, you know, an LGBTQ-only publication because we would be the only ones that cared. But I think it's pretty significant that this was by NBC News and covered by them in this way. But they dissected the Trump administration's new panel, a human rights panel, and its members, including the commissioner or the head of the panel, Mary Ann Glendon, who was a former U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, an outspoken opponent of abortion, and has spoken out against same-sex marriage on many occasions over the past two decades. But I also want to read what they put down as the bulk of this committee. And this is due from an analysis done by GLAAD. And they found that 7 out of the 10 that have been named to this commission have a history of fighting against LGBTQ progress. And I'm just going to go through these people really quickly. Among the members that GLAAD highlighted are Peter Berkowitz, who in 2003 called the Supreme Court ruling that decriminalized homosexuality dangerous. Sheikh Hamza Yusuf Hansen, who said that in 2011 that same-sex marriage is a sign of the end times. Meyer Slokovic, who in 2012 wrote a blurb that an anti-LGBTQ book was an influential defense of marriage as it has been historically and rightly understood. Jacqueline Rivers, who in 2014 said same-sex marriage diminished straight union. Krister Tolfsen, who in 2015 said gender transitions are, quote, a mark of a heartless culture. And F. Cartwright Weiland, who in 2017 worked for a think tank that calls marriage, quote, a permanent relationship between one man and one woman. So for me, knowing that this was going to be essentially the makeup of this commission, I still found my jaw dropping. What say you guys?
The problem with this is that this all fits the narrative that the Christian right has been using as a vehicle with this particular administration. I mean, Tony Perkins, who's president of the notoriously, you know, anti-LGBTQ Family Research Council, was practically hopping up and down in joy over the announcement of this so-called natural law, you know, commission. And it's disturbing because you also have to look at the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and he's a Dominionist, and he's an end timer, and he's one of these Tea Party type Christian evangelical folks that, you know, has no love for women's reproductive rights, other religions outside of their peculiar interpretation of whatever it is they believe. Particularly, you know, they target the Islamic faith. You know, this is all part and parcel of this. And I'll note that NBC reported that Sarah Ellis, who's the CEO of GLAAD, called the commission a farce. And then she turned right around and accused the administration of knowingly appointed activists who made careers out of fighting against LGBT progress in people. And that's absolutely true. You look at one of the, you know, folks that has here, the president, Mike Pence, and then, you know, his little cobble, which Brent and I have dealt with them before during the transmilitary ban process. There's no love lost. And again, it also ties in with the United States walking away from the human rights panel of the United Nations. This is all fitting within their kind of crazy narrative. Bryn, you want to throw your two cents in?
So they've said that the entire panel is based on looking at human rights from a natural law perspective, which you have to understand natural law is an Augustinian philosophy that you can derive what God intends and what is good from the natural purpose of things you see. So a penis and a vagina are for making babies, that's it. That is the only thing they are for. Any other use for them besides making a baby is bad and evil because that's not God, what God made it for. And applying that sort of barely medieval philosophy to human rights does not work out well for the LGBT community, nor is it one that actually works out particularly well for human rights, given the role of the Catholic Church during the Renaissance, i.e. they were fighting it tooth and nail the entire way. But keep in mind that that's the philosophy that's being applied now, that it's a religious philosophy, that it is why Mike Pompeo, and I'm paraphrasing here, said that some things that are perceived as rights are actually evil. And he said this in a speech describing it, and it's a line that you see the religious right taking up more and more, that, well, once you start calling everything a human right, nothing is a right. That's Tony Perkins. And what they are really saying when you read between the lines is that we want to remove the concept that access to birth control, access to abortion, allowance for same-sex marriage, even Lawrence v. Texas, the right for people to have sex with whom they choose, should be reconsidered, that they are not right, that you do not have a right to get married, nor do you even have a right to have sex with your partner if the state determines it so. And there's been some big hints dropped under Jeff Sessions when speaking with the Alliance Defending Freedom that they wanted to overturn Obergefell. And in the past, Attorney General William Barr has written things that would lead you to conclude he would love to see Lawrence versus Texas overturned. And I think that's one of the end state goals of this, is to try and start working to peel back not just abortion rights and marriage rights, but to get back to a place where access to birth control and to bring back sodomy laws are on the table.
Do you feel that this commission will have any credibility? I mean, that seems to be one of the strategic downfalls of the Trump administration. I mean, not only are they standing for idiotic things, but the people he puts in place don't get much traction because they do need some credible footing to be effective, and they're so inept and so destructive to their different roles that they have trouble even establishing that. Will this commission have any clout?
And
I mean,
answer
I doubt
is,
it. I doubt
can
it.
Can I disagree with you ever so slightly, Brody?
Yeah, go ahead, Brody. I'm just saying I doubt it from the standpoint that this is being run by the U.S. State Department, and you look at the more progressive governments in Europe and even progressive governments in the Asian areas that are going to look at some of these things, which are blatantly and patently, you know, Christian evangelical nonsense. And I honestly, you know, when you start, especially if you start talking places like France, Germany, in countries where they practice, you know, secularism, I don't think that they're going to look at this, and they're going to kind of look at it with a jaded eye. The danger, though, and here's where the problem is places like sub-Saharan Africa and third world countries, and, of course, countries in the Middle East. That's where this type of thing will probably get the most bang for the buck, particularly in Africa, which has been a target of American Christian evangelicals for a very long time. I will refer back to 10 years ago when Lou Engle and Scott Lively and those folks essentially were able to get Uganda to formulate what was known as the Kill the Gays Law. So I think that there will be some impact there. And, yes, that sort of thing where evangelical presences, even in some parts of Latin America, there will be some credibility. But I think in terms of Western Europe and Asia and places like that, no. Bryn?
So what I think this is going to do is it's going to provide misinformation that will be misused, the same way that the religious right will sponsor a study that produces absolute crap results like Regnerus or Littman, and then they will tout the results of this bogus study to say, oh, look at what this found, and look at the highfalutin-sounding titles that go with it, and this is the position of U.S. government, and have that support, at least for now, and even 10 years from now, they're still going to be referring to what this committee comes up with to sound like there's some sort of authority behind it, even if there isn't, or that there's some sort of rigor behind it. I also would point out that I think that, yes, sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East, this is going to have effect, but where I'm afraid it's going to have the most impact is places like Poland, Hungary, Russia, Moldova, Ukraine, places where the World Congress of Families is trying to bring together various and assorted religious forces that are trying to use natural law as a basis for federal or state law. And this it has a very Catholic bent, as you might imagine, being that it's a Catholic philosophy, but it's being embraced at the same time by evangelicals and the Eastern Orthodox Church. And so where I expect to see this getting a lot of play is Eastern Europe, the World Congress of Families, which acts as the intermediary between the religious right in the United States and religious right organizations throughout Eastern Europe and even parts of Western Europe, particularly Italy, where you have the Catholic Church still holds a great deal of power.
Well, you guys, great input. And we've got to watch this group. And I absolutely hear Bryn's point, you know, in terms of them creating essentially a dogma that then becomes a cited, quote-unquote, study, even though it's based in complete fiction, and the danger of that moving forward. I want to move us
what
on
makes it
to
particularly dangerous
things.
Is that the countries right, where this is taking hold is, and particularly popular places that have entered a phase of illiberal democracy, which the U.S. is as well. So this is particularly worrying. It gives us a vision into where we're going.
Absolutely. And yeah, that's why I wanted to put these people out there, because we need to know them, we need to know what they're doing, and we need to know what they're saying. And we need to counter it in all the ways that we can. Speaking of countering things and jumping into the fray, a friend of this program and a guest here previously is running for office. Brody, you want to tell us about Sarah McBride's newly launched campaign?
Absolutely. I'm so thrilled for my friend Sarah. She announced, I believe yesterday, that she is seeking a state Senate seat in Wilmington, Delaware, and the seat currently is occupied by a good Democrat who's retiring. A former governor of the state of Delaware has endorsed her. She's getting endorsements from a tremendous amount of folk within the Democratic Party. I fully expect to hear the former vice president endorse her efforts, being how her family and the Biden family have been close for an incredibly long period of time. We used to kid Sarah because back in the day she was a huge West Wing fan, and everything, of course, was revolving around West Wing and, you know, getting started and things like that. So she's making her first foray, as it were, into local politics. I'm so happy for her. I think she'll make an incredible state lawmaker. And I'll be honest with you, I fully expect to see her take a run for the U.S. House or possibly even the U.S. Senate after she's done it in the state House. So congratulations, and Sarah, if you're listening, so happy for you.
Yeah, that's very exciting. And, you know, it's really thrilling. I mean, there are only apparently about 700 transgender individuals who are serving in elected office across the country. And, you know, it's been my pleasure to know a couple of them. And it's just, it's really a really great thing. So, wishing her well, and can't wait to hear positive results back on that. And Brody, I want to turn that over to you for additional stories that we wanted to talk about tonight.
Well, one of the things that I think is kind of significant, Brent and I actually, in transparency, discussed this off air previous, but the U.S. House today, it approved an amendment as part of major defense policy legislation that not only would restore transgender military service, but it would prohibit the U.S. Armed Forces from discriminating against any LGBT service members. The measure, which was introduced by Representative Jackie Speier of California, passed on a party line vote of 242 to 187, and that was with Republicans. I think we had 10 Republicans. And it was included as part of the upcoming 2020 Defense Authorization Bill, which is an annual appropriations bill that has to pass through. Congresswoman Speier said in a statement that was released to the Washington Blade and other media outlets, that this vote is a watershed moment in the fight to celebrate and protect open transgender military service. Courageous transgender service members continue to fight for our country despite the president's hateful ban, and deserve to know that we stand with them. Our country has a shameful history of preventing people from serving based on bias, ignorance, and malice. This is the first time Congress has voted to ensure no discriminatory standard based on race, religion, national origin, or sex can prevent qualified individuals from serving their country. The amendment was known as the Harry Truman Amendment. It was modeled after an executive order which desegregated the U.S. Armed Forces in 1948, by President Harry S. Truman. In the amendment, it states the language, the military must consider applicants based on gender-neutral occupational standards and military occupational speciality, but may not include any criteria relating to race, color, national origin, religion, or sex, including gender identity or sexual orientation of an individual. So this is a pretty big thing. Of course, the fact that we've seen this come to fruition is kind of probably the most significant thing. Brynn, of course, is a graduate of the United States Naval Academy. She is a former chopper pilot, and she's also flown fixed-wing aircraft. And as a naval aviator, it's kind of important, the standards that apply for this, particularly since Brynn and I also have mutual friends who are still serving. I'd call out Staff Sergeant Logan Ireland of the United States Air Force, Captain Jennifer Peace of the United States Army, and, of course, Lieutenant Commander Blake Trenum of the United States Navy, among many other fine serving members of the U.S. Armed Forces who happen to be trans. I think what the Congresswoman and the Democrats did with this particular piece of legislation is that they just called out that, this type of discriminatory practice has got to end. Now, I am going to call out the Republicans because I think it's kind of important that we do recognize them. And these would be Representative Susan Brooks of Indiana, Brian Patrick of Pennsylvania, Troy Hollingsworth also of Indiana, William Hurd of Texas, Tom Katko of New York, Tom Reed also of New York, Elise Stefanik also from the New York delegations, Steve Severs of Ohio, Fred Upton from Michigan, Greg Walden from Oregon. There was an 11th vote of Representative Michael Waltz of Florida, but apparently he changed his vote at the last second. This is kind of important.
So, Brody, Brody, I wanted to ask you a question on that. So, of the 10 Republicans, I mean, what can we do to make this a bipartisan effort? It seems to me that this is one issue that we could get Republicans to support, not all of them, obviously, but a good percentage, because this is, first of all, it's the right thing to do. There is no credible reason behind the discrimination, and it is, highlighting individuals in our country who are doing what the ultimate that we ask them to do, which is to serve the country. I would think that Republicans could find a lot there that they could stand up for without violating any, Republican, held tenet that they might otherwise have to walk away from it. So are we surprised that only 10 signed up for this? Are we surprised that 10 did at all? What is the feeling on that?
I mean, I'll be perfectly, honest with you, three years ago when we were fighting the trans military ban and amendment that was authored by Representative Vicki Hartzler in Missouri, which was also being attached to a defense authorization bill. We ended up looking out that the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, was able to get 6 Republicans to vote against the Hartzler Amendment, so it failed on the House floor. That was significant. I think that 10 Republicans crossing the aisle, given, quite frankly, the political climate, is also significant. Does it send a message? I mean, it sends a message that there are people that are willing to compromise and that there are people who are willing to appreciate and embrace, the core value here, and that is that the transgender service members are no different than their counterparts. that basically, you know, any person, any American who puts on a uniform is fighting for their country, and that should be acknowledged, and that, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity should not play a role in that, just like race shouldn't play a role in it, just like, you know, any other aspect of it. It should be based, you know, on a person's qualifications and the ability to execute the job. But when you're talking about the Republicans, again, you're talking about a party that is now held captive by the evangelical right. And the Trump administration is an absolute reflection of that fact. I think it's significant that 10 crossed the aisle. I find it interesting, though, that the delegations across the aisle, okay, were from Indiana and New York. Indiana, because that's Mike Pence country, and New York, because normally you don't see that type of thing. New York has kind of a thing where the Democrats will vote one way and the Republicans will vote the other. And at least the last almost 15 years, I haven't seen them cross over very often. So I find it significant that that delegation of those three from New York did so.
Brent, your
that's
thoughts
my
on
answer, Brent.
So this is huge. When we first started working on Open Trans Service in 2013, the consensus among our group was that there was absolutely no good that can come from anything happening in Congress on our issue. Even if we did not sense that there was any Democratic will to work the issue, there was no real movement to it. There wasn't public sentiment. I commented to Brody earlier that perhaps nothing in America has moved so fast on LGBT issues as marriage and transmilitary. These could be considered kind of the two crowning successes of the movement over the past decade, along with perhaps Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a long time coming. Trans service came out of nowhere and happened fast. We're seeing support for open trans service that's hitting 60% in Texas. And all of the polling shows it between 60 and 70% nationally. So this is, you know, to paraphrase Joe Biden, this is a BFD. Where this gets a little bit more interesting is what's going to happen in the Senate. What Brody didn't mention is that there is there's been a lot of posturing by the White House on this bill. Because the Democrats are only including $733 billion for defense, and the White House wants $750. They're calling it a line in the sand. They're threatening vetoes. They're threatening vetoes over this. There is talk that in the Senate they just want to strip this out, and they want to see if they can get Democrats to blink and accept taking out protections for LGBT service members as a bargaining chip. And there's also the threat of a veto. Keep in mind that George W. Bush exercised a pocket veto of an NDAA when the Democrats held the House in 2008. So it wouldn't be unheard of to have a veto or a pocket veto of this. My biggest fear in all of this is that Democrats trade away transgender service for some other shiny object in the NDAA. And if the trans community got wind of that, it could be absolutely devastating, the same way that inclusion of transgender people in the Employment Non-Discrimination Act of 2007-2008 got bargained away. The trans community was basically alienated from the larger movement for almost a decade. And that's the last thing we want, given that we need unity facing such an existential threat as this administration. So this is definitely one of those great news and, okay, with great, you know, great opportunity also comes great danger, that this could, the Democrats, I believe, need to stick to their guns, or it could actually make matters worse.
I think that she's right.
Yeah,
Well, I was going to point out the bright, shiny object that, you know, Bren was talking about. There actually is one on the table already. And if you consider that under a veto threat or a conference, threat coming out of the Senate, and the Democrats get desperate For example, Representative Mark DeCano of California attached an amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act, which is what we're talking about. This would preserve protections for deportations for undocumented military families. That would be critically important because, as it stands, the administration is threatening to deport the family. And this is even with people in combat scenarios. And I think Burton's right that that could be a trade-off back and forth, and that does get a little frightening because, you know, would the vote to support trans military service go away because the immigration issue from Takano's perspective on his amendment to prevent deportation of family members of serving members of the U.S. military, it just becomes kind of a what's the lesser of the two evils. I'm sorry, Rob. I had to add that in there because Brent nailed that.
Which is kind of funny because both of those amendments would affect me. I got married to a Canadian a week before I deployed back in 2000. So we were worried about what would happen with her visa. So
you've got skin in all the games. I can see a scenario where that whole thing could turn, though, because if one of the big issues is the amount of defense funding, which the Democrats are traditionally withholding on, that is a compromise that they could make, you know, giving the Trump administration more financial power and basically making them sell their souls on these two items together. Bryn, my question to you would be, would you and others be interested, willing to meet with Republican senators to kind of play the humanistic card? And if so, which ones would you want to target?
Well, I can say that I already have met with some senators' offices. I've met with Martha McSally's office and talked about the fact that I'm a pilot, that I actually have been trying to get back in to the National Guard, and I passed my flight physical, that I cost the military and the National Guard absolutely nothing. They don't have to pay for my transition. It's done. It's not disruptive. There is nothing that I have an extraordinary amount of passing privilege, so I'm not disruptive. I don't cost anything. The National Guard is absolutely desperate for pilots. I'm physically qualified, so why would you want to reject somebody who's bringing $1.5 million worth of aviation training, who's physically qualified and good to go today, and has 4 combat deployments under her belt, just because of a rule that really doesn't seem to apply to me in any sense, or any of the rationales for it don't seem to apply, especially when I'm going to be filling a critical billet in some place like California, where I would be flying helicopters and dumping Bambi buckets of water on fires that threaten metropolitan areas. This is you can draw a direct line to the skills that transgender people have and bring to the table directly impact our ability to execute the missions that are important to people, not just at the federal level, but at the state level as well. I would also say that there's other Republicans, like, surprisingly, I think Mitt Romney would be perhaps open to this. I think he's probably movable as well, from what I know of him.
I think so, too. I think if you look at the Senate Armed Services Committee, in particular, at least as far as the Republican leadership goes, you know, your problematic ones, obviously, are the chairperson, James Inhofe of Oklahoma.
We will not get past him. So
yeah, the other one that's problematic, of course, is Tom Cotton of Arkansas. Tom Tillis of North Carolina is also problematic. David Perdue of Georgia, practically rabid. And then Josh Hawley of Missouri, and he's a Hartzler fan. So those would be your problematic ones. Now, on the minority side of armed services, you've got just, you know, huge, huge, huge supporters in Senator Kristen Gillibrand of New York, Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, and of course, a vet and a former pilot, Tammy Duckworth of Illinois. But to Rob's point and to Rob's question, you really would have to work around the hardliners and the, on the, at least on Senate Armed Services, the ones that I just mentioned on the Republican side are definite hardliners. You know, Deb Fisher of Nebraska, maybe. Joni Ernst of Iowa, you know, she's a former, you know, serving officer. Yeah, you know, that one's hard to, that one's kind of hard to call. You know, McSally, who you already mentioned, Brent. And you got Rick Scott of Florida, you know, and he's, you know, he's got a little bit over the, you know, all over the map. And then, of course, you got Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. She's an absolute hardliner. So there's some problematic ones there, at least in terms of, you know, the Senate Armed Services Committee. But looking at the leadership of the Senate in general, I think we're still going back to the shiny object thing that Brem mentioned earlier, that the transmilitary service of the Truman Amendment, at least in conference, would, you know, get kicked out because the Democrats desperately wanted something else to remain in. The other part of this is that we don't have a serving Secretary of Defense, and we've got kind of an uproar going right now with the Joint Chiefs. As a matter of fact, one of the line officers or flag officers that was mentioned for a replacement withdrew from consideration for Chair JCS, and there's a bunch of other things going on there. So this is a problematic time for this amendment.
So, Brody, I kind of want to ask you a similar angle question, being our representative of the media in general. Obviously, you come from the journalistic side of the media, but what could be done to present this, and to Bryn's point, this is, you know, from the public opinion standpoint, you know, real momentum can be leveraged here, where there are different people in the media who talk to the Republicans at large. Meghan McCain on The View, for example, who is very pro-LGBT, you know, and I think there's probably some Fox News punditry that could be otherwise conservative, but on this issue would be able to present this so that the Republican senators would have a greater comfort level of standing up in support and feeling patriotic rather than like they were swimming against their party's principles.
I think the most important. Well, I, you know, speaking in terms of my profession, I think we've absolutely done a really bad job of, you know, putting the issue in specific relief. We need to be able to take and get the public to understand that there is absolutely no difference in deployability, lethality, or professional competence of any trans member of any of the five services, okay, than their counterparts. And in some cases, they excel. You know, I point again to Staff Sergeant Logan Ireland. I point to Commander Drennan, to Captain Peace, you know, Bryn when she was still wearing a uniform. I mean, this is the whole thing that we need to do is we need to put into specific relief the fact that there is absolutely, okay, without any hesitation, anything that would bar service of these people. You know, the Republicans have got to stop you know, hiding behind pseudoscience. They've got to stop hiding behind deployability issues, lethality issues. It's ridiculous. They've got to look at this in an overall sense. And here's the thing. The last polling numbers we've got, which I think, Bryn, what was that, about 2 months ago, we were sitting at well over 67% of the American public was good with trans-military service. Actually, I think we hit 70%. Okay?
In one poll, 70%. We did hit 70.
Yeah,
the lowest I've seen in a year has been 61%, and I've seen it hit 70, 71%, with the average coming out right around two-thirds. And I mean, even if you look at like Fox News, you don't see Fox News banging on this. They weren't banging on it before the president did it. They weren't banging on it afterwards. This and the fact that we've done such a good job of getting Meghan McCain, we've gotten good people out front, we've created great sound bites, we've put good people forward to see what transgender service members really look like. The Trans Military Documentary Film Project. This is not a winning issue for Republicans. The question to me is whether or not holding up the NDAA and insisting on including transgender service members, will the American public say no, just, you know, move on, you know, and protecting transgender people isn't worth a veto or worth failing in reconciliation between the two bills, the House and the Senate version, or is the American public going to say yes? This was unfair. Are they going to same thing with the service members who marry foreign nationals? Are they going to say no? These people need to be able to deploy, go do their job overseas in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, wherever, without worrying that their spouse is going to get deported while they're away and not able to protect them. You know, these are the American public is on the side of Democrats on this, but the question is, will they continue to be on their side if Democrats hold their ground? I would hope they are, but I think our buddy Nate Silver would say that the numbers are probably going to come out and even split if you did polling on whether Democrats should stand their ground. I'm hoping that they do. This is one of those times where I believe that more than ever we need to be standing on principle of things rather than playing politics as usual when people's lives are at stake.
The only fly
I think part of the reason this has even been brought to the table is the Democrats wanting to clarify who we as Democrats are coming up into the 2020. And I don't think that, you know, if it turns out to be a back off point, that obviously would make the opposite of that statement. So I'm hoping that that alone gives it the firepower of to stay in there. We definitely shall watch it. And I think we should put pressure, knowing that that could happen. That's why we should not be complacent about this and just take a wait and see attitude, but actively campaign across both sides of the aisle for it. Brody, go ahead.
Well, I think that's important what you just said. And I would say that, the fly in the suit here is the Senate Majority Leader. And, you know, he's already made, you know, his stated position on this quite clear. But I think
I have to interject there. Calling him a mere fly in the soup is a compliment. But anyway, go ahead with your point.
I think that, you know, the other thing that is going to be an absolute necessity is that the Democratic front runners are also going to have to take and make an issue out of this. I think that if it made it through conference and it was in fact headed to the White House for signature, I honestly don't think Trump would probably veto it. And the reason he probably wouldn't is because he would risk alienating the defense establishment. And if anybody and everybody has come to terms on it and McConnell has let that legislation through, then there's a good chance the president won't veto it. Now, that might anger his evangelical base, but, you know, it's how many poison pills are going to be in there. Remember, the White House position on this is that there's two poison pills already. The trans-military ban is, you know, being – overturned with the amendment is one. And the second one is Takano's amendment dealing with, the families of service members who are undocumented to prevent what they call, it's parole. Basically, they just won't deport them. And it's keeping it within the current immigration law. Now, that brings another dynamic into play as well, and that is Stephen Miller, who is the power behind the throne with all the anti-immigration thing. I can actually see Miller joining forces with Pence and everybody else on pressure that those two issues or those two poison pills would cause problems. And again, a lot is going to depend on, you know, whether or not there would be enough Republican senators that would be willing to join with the Democrats to push it through. And that's really what it comes down to. Go ahead, Brent.
So, Brody, you bring up a good point, and this comes back to something that was said earlier, is that if for some reason Democrats came back with a bill that came out of offered basically, yeah, you can have something way closer to your $750 billion, but we keep Takano and Spears and Anthony Brown's amendments, Republicans start having a very hard time saying no, because the defense establishment doesn't really care about those things because they're minor. They're decimal dust in the military budget and tracking systems. But $17 billion for weapon systems modernization, maintenance facilities, that's not decimal dust. That's significant. That's crucial. They believe it's crucial to their efforts to modernize, to meet the growing threat in places like the Baltics. So if you've got that on the table, if you've got the money on the table, does Trump veto a $750 billion defense budget because it protects trans people and immigrant spouses? The defense establishment's probably going to be saying, for the love of God, don't do it. But
yeah, and
internally, you're going to have Pence and Miller screaming, veto it. But
yeah. In
terms of public, I don't think that there's going to be a lot of public support for vetoing a defense bill that gives the military all the money it wanted, or nearly all the money it wanted, just because it protects trans people and immigrant spouses, which isn't particularly popular, weren't particularly popular Republican stances anyway.
Sure.
And bottom line, that is where Trump lives. He's, you know, if it comes with money, you know, that he gets blind to a lot of other things that he cared about 10 minutes ago. So I think that is the thing that could make this a winning ticket. But it also then, you know, it is the Democrats selling out on their fiscal priorities that they might have otherwise had. Although none of the Democratic frontrunners are saying anything about cutting defense as being as something that they are particularly wanting to do. So
we're,
I think it could be a win-win all the way around.
We're already running a $1 trillion a year deficit. Adding $17 billion to defense adds, what, 1.7% of that total, 0.17%? It's kind of, when you're standing on, do we allow gross human rights violations and degradation of LGBT rights to occur in the United States? Or do we... when you're already that far in the hole, what's another, couple quarters?
Right.
I'm hoping that Democrats take a stand on this, because the deficit isn't something that they can address with just, you know, withholding $17 billion from the defense budget.
Well, I think this show has laid out a very persuasive case, quite frankly, for both sides. I hope they listen to us, because I think we've made the point across the board. There's really no lose for anybody who supports it, you know, ups the defense budget and includes it and makes this, the sweetened defense budget carry these moral right principles along with it. And it also, that also feeds into kind of a Keynesian economic thing that when you borrow for your defense, that it actually does heighten up the economy in general. So I think it could be a huge positive for everybody.
And I would point out that only the absolute most rabid right, religious right figures actually care about transgender military stuff. Even your fairly conservative Republicans don't care that much. I can say that a Republican who voted for an NDAA that gave the full budget to the Department of Defense but included allowing transgender people to serve is not going to lose their primary over it.
Sure. I agree.
So Republicans, do not be afraid. You can support this, and you are going to be okay. We promise. Brody, there were a couple other news stories you wanted to touch on before we wound up this evening.
Well, I want to talk about the census, and I'm going to tie the census to the immigration raids that are going to occur this weekend because they're directly related. And the way they're related is that the White House, the president essentially dropped his effort to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. Now, what he's going to do instead is he is going to issue an executive order that the entire federal bureaucracy is to provide all of their citizenship records to the Department of Commerce, which oversees the census. So the win for most people with this one is the fact that the census form won't ask for citizenship. That means the count will be more accurate. The backdooring of the information coming out of these other federal agencies a year ago, actually, I think more than a year ago, the Census Bureau authored a memo which said that they would do a better job of collecting citizenship data using the existing government administrative records than, you know, going through the census itself. So it's a two-way street for them. Now, I'm sure, okay, that Miller and the Hawks that have been banging the drum on the immigration issue probably were less than thrilled by this. But, you know, there were some problems with this. Even after the Supreme Court kicked it back, the president basically, let it be known that this was all about partisan, you know, politicking. Well, that's, you know, not the point for the census in terms of overalls. It's not supposed to be, but Trump made it that way. And, you know, the thing was is that it was pitting the administration and Trump in particular, you know, especially against state and local city officials. You know, they were warning, okay, that question would decrease participation from those communities, all right, and that would jeopardize federal funding. And that's true, it would. The census results are used to determine, you know, more than just draw congressional districts. It's disbursement of federal aid. You know, with that being in there, okay, and suddenly you've got entire, you know, communities of minorities that are underreported or not participating at all, that's going to directly impact, you know, federal funding and federal aid, you know, for some very, very important things. You know, and again, the whole thing with the Trump White House doing this, okay, was again, okay, all aimed in such a way that, you know, you couldn't construe it any other way than just, you know, profiling, okay? Now, why this is also important, this weekend, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks are supposedly going to arrest well over 2,000 undocumented immigrants who have already been issued what they call final orders of deportation. And apparently it's supposed to get started Sunday morning. From what we're understanding, from what we're being told by ICE, is this will be a multi-day operation. And there's already been significant pushback on this. One of the things that Speaker Pelosi said today in her press conference with us in the press corps, and I want to reiterate this to our listeners, okay, unless an immigration and customs enforcement agent has a warrant signed by a judge, you are not obligated to open that door. You don't have to open the door. And ICE agents are going to sit there and say that an immigration order is the same thing. It's not. If that warrant is not signed by a federal judge, you do not have to open that door and you do not have to cooperate. So that's one of the things that's kind of, you know, really important. And here's the top three things I want to emphasize. Number one, I do not wish to speak with you or answer your questions. I'm exercising my constitutional right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution to remain silent. Number two, I want to speak to a lawyer before answering any of your questions. Number three, I do not give you permission to enter my home. Okay? So, you know, folks, if you're confronting ICE personnel over the weekend, especially if you are trans or queer, more marginalized folks in the LGBTQI community who may be undocumented, okay, don't fall for the I have an arrest warrant. If that doesn't have a judge's signature on it, yeah, guess what? It ain't the real deal.
So really, really good input there, Brody, and I hope that gets that information gets to the people who need it. Unfortunately, I have to institute my own directive here, in that I cannot let you continue any further because we're out of time. So anyway, thank you so much, Bryn. Thank you so much for joining us yet again. And your voice and thoughts and input is always highly, highly valuable and insightful. And we're so incredibly grateful for you. Brody, thank you for your insight and brilliance as always. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. We will be back again next week, this same time, same place. Check us out. Also, check out on www.blogtalkradio.com/ratedLGBT radio, our archive. You need to listen to our past shows. There's lots of good stuff there. Plus, on Saturday nights, listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com. You can live stream it there, 7 p.m. Pacific time, 10 p.m. Eastern time. So for Bryn and for Brody and myself, I want to bid you a very, very good night. Stay safe, do the right thing, and let's fight this whole thing forward.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.